How's it going? My name is Joshua Faust. I'm a freelance journalist writing about national security stuff. Who am I talking to today?
I'm James Joyner. I'm the managing editor of the Atlanta Council for another couple of days and soon to be a professor of strategic studies at the Marine Command Staff College in Quantico.
Cool. So by way of background, to kind of intro what we're talking about today, I am a pretty recent refugee from the think tank universe. And before that, I used to be a senior intelligence analyst for the U.S. Military Intelligence Community.
Right.
And I'm bringing this up because your background, both working in national security policy, before that in the U.S. Army, and also as an academic studying national security and soon to be teaching it to other soldiers, and my own, both working in this universe, is kind of germane to talking about the events of the last 24 hours,
yes.
Which was the conviction of Bradley Manning on, I think, 6 counts of espionage resulting in 35 years of jail time.
Right. No, absolutely.
Okay. Sorry, the pause threw me for a loop there. So there are a lot of issues raised with this, including the name Bradley Manning, which we'll be talking about a little bit after this.
Yes.
We're recording this exactly 24 hours after he was convicted for actually a very long time. 35 years is a very, very big sentence, especially in the context of other military, other court-martial sentences recently. And I think it's worth talking about why that is and about why Manning got such a long sentence.
Yeah, that's right. It's it's an interesting situation in that he's been sentenced to much more than people who've been convicted of or certainly been accused of various pretty horrendous war crimes. But the
right.
problem
and,
is
and
it's
so
just
going
the,
through some of
the scope. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think going through some of these is instructive because this is something that human rights groups have been bringing up the last 24 hours, is that in comparison to other incidents, like a Marine Special Operations team in Afghanistan that killed 19 civilians, the kill team in Kandahar got only 10 years in prison. The Marines who were involved in the Haditha killings didn't face any jail time at all.
Right.
And even Edward Snowden, who leaked documents at a higher classification, his maximum sentence that he's facing is still only 30 years, which is
right.
less than Manning's actual sentence. So,
yeah.
I mean, why do you think why do you think Manning got such a harsh prison sentence?
I think it's a couple things. I mean, one, it's, you know, his case is just such a slam dunk, right? I mean, the Haditha massacre, while horrific, and we think pretty well what we know what went on there, there were no witnesses that were willing to come forward. Obviously, most of the key witnesses were killed. And, you know, the others that were there and even some who, you know, talked to investigators initially ultimately refused out of fear for their safety to come forward and testify. And that made mm-hmm. conviction very, very, very difficult. In fact, apparently impossible. We didn't reach the standard of proof. Whereas Manning doesn't deny what he did, you know, very public about what he did, and is basically arguing for leniency, and you know, and did in fact manage to escape conviction on the most serious of the charges of aiding the enemy. But
yeah.
And the fact that he stole these materials and handed them over to Julian Assange for public dissemination is not a dispute. The other thing I
yeah.
think that is simply the function of you know, the fact that he did this from the comfort of, a command center, not under fire, versus, you know, making decisions in a war zone and the exigencies of combat and the fog of war and fear and, you know, all of those things. I think you get much less sympathy from a military jury.
The combat exemption is probably really important here. One of the most common complaints that people have said about this conviction is that the two helicopter pilots in the so-called collateral murder video that Manning leaked
right.
never faced any charges.
Yeah.
And some of the missing context of that video is that they weren't just out there looking for people to kill off. They were providing close air support to soldiers who had
yep.
already come under fire from insurgents in that neighborhood on that same day. And in the group where those two Reuters journalists were killed were insurgents carrying weapons, including one with an RPG. And that's, I think, really important information when you're asking, sure, why would a helicopter pilot just be firing on these? They weren't looking for journalists to go kill. They were protecting U.S. soldiers in the area who were already being attacked.
Right.
And the fact that I think in a way the reason why, like, the kill team in Kandahar is facing jail time instead of just facing an investigation and being let off is because they weren't just doing terrible things in the midst of combat, which is unfortunately what happens in combat because combat is right. awful. They were making a premeditated decision to go do these things. Similarly right. with Manning, he made a premeditated decision over a period of several weeks, went through enormous effort actually to exfiltrate these kinds of documents. And I think in a way it's that deliberateness, that intentionality that that they're trying to punish and deter in the future.
Well, that's right. And in fact, you know, in terms of the message you want to send here, right? I mean, we don't want to have any sort of ambiguity on whether privates first class can steal classified materials and disseminate them to the general public. Right? That's
exactly.
pretty cut and dry. We do not want that. On the other hand, while, you know, we want the laws of war respected, we want, you know, innocence not to, to be killed, we want our, you know, attack helicopter pilots to be willing to engage and not be second-guessing themselves much. You know what I'm saying? You need them out there being aggressive and, you know, making instant decisions as to, you know, who the bad guys are, and especially in a situation where they're close to American troops and you need to make sure that you're protecting them. You almost want them to lean on the side of shooting if you've got a good target. And so that's a very different mindset.
Yeah, so if I could adopt the kind of standard emo prog objection to this, what you're saying is that America wants to safeguard the right to kill, but not the right to inform the public.
Well, I mean, certainly America's military, right? I mean, if you have the very basis of a system of classification is that, only people who have a need to know the information and have been cleared to have that information are allowed to see it. And if you let any idiot private decide that, to circumvent that, you don't have a process of secret information. I think pretty sensitive to that sort of thing.
So let's actually talk about this need to know then, because that's an interesting wrinkle to this. Manning didn't just wake up one day and decide to do this. It actually came after a long series of discipline issues with him, including punching a female superior officer in the face during an argument.
It was same sex, so it's not as horrific as it sounds when he's a man, right? So.
Yeah, I mean, like, he hadn't transitioned or really announced right. his gender identity at that point. So, I mean, he was still identifying himself as a male, I think. I hope I'm not
stepping on
his toes at that point. But he was at least publicly identifiable as a male at the time.
Right.
And punching a female superior officer in the face. Doesn't matter. He punched a superior officer in the
right.
face. And that even that was at the end of a long series of altercation, something even his defense lawyer said, why did the military keep putting him in positions where he would handle sensitive materials after
right.
he was demonstrating all of these discipline issues? And especially since we're also dealing this week with the court-martial of Major Nidal Hassan, the guy who shot up Fort Hood, who had the same kind of issues, a series of disciplinary problems before he committed this crime. I think it's worth asking why actually so many soldiers are being allowed to stay in sensitive positions after demonstrating through their own behavior that they really shouldn't be.
I mean, it's unfortunately, I think the nature of, you know, volunteer force is that, you know, during times of extended war, especially unpopular wars such as we're fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, you've just got to have the numbers. And so what happens is standards go down. You start taking in people who you wouldn't have taken before. You take people without high school degrees. You take people, you know, with criminal backgrounds. You take people who are overweight. At the level of the officer corps, you know, it's literally for people who came in when I did, it was harder to make captain than it was to make colonel in terms of selection rates, right? It's just the numbers game changes. So, you know, you get somebody, you know, it's hard to find, you know, people who are willing to enlist in the Army during a time of combat and to do it for very low pay, as you get as a private, even as a private first class. And you know, to find somebody smart enough to do the intelligence work is hard. And so when you got somebody that's got the aptitude, I think that the inclination is to, you know, well, we can save this guy. You know, sort of like, you know, in pro sports, you get somebody who's, you know, got all sorts of behavioral problems, but, you know, they've got talent. They're 7 foot tall and 350 pounds and, you know, the fact that they get arrested for, you know, DUI 3 weeks in a row, is, you know, sort of overlooked for a while. And, you know, we have that in the Army, you know, and in the case of Hassan, I think you have the additional problem of, you know, he gave, you know, made these outrageous, you know, sort of pro-jihadi statements, but there's a sensitivity both on sort of racial and religious grounds right now, you know, that you want to bend over backwards, you know, with a Muslim officer, to make sure that you're not, you know, sort of being discriminatory or seen as discriminatory. You know, and again, you know, he's a medical doctor, so that, you know, you know that's a skill set that we need as well. So it's in hindsight, you know, it really looks horrific. Even in plain, you know, sort of looking at it, I think it was clearly a bad decision making, but I understand the forces behind it.
Yeah, so I mean, in a way, you could almost say that both of those incidents. And in a way, a lot of these other violent disciplinary actions, people like the kill team, are a consequence just of the way the wars themselves were structured, because they lasted so long and the need to keep people in uniform grew so great that in a way the U.S. just opened itself up to this kind of misconduct.
Yeah, and it's not a new thing. And again, going back, even we had it during Vietnam, which we had a much more plentiful, you know, supplies as we had a draft going on. But, you know, we talked sort of preliminary discussions about, you know, William Callett, who was obviously unfit to be an officer. All the military services had
And William Callett, by the way, is the platoon leader who pulled off the My Lai massacre, just to, so in case people didn't realize, like, who Callett was off the top of their head.
Right. No, that's a fair point. When you take these people and you lower your standards and you hope for the best, you're going to get burned occasionally. It's in some ways shocking we haven't had more of these incidents. I guess just the scale of it is what it is. But yeah, it's tragic, but not totally unexpected.
This raises, I think, and we can talk about kind of the particulars of that point too, of why there aren't more of these incidents, because that's a question that has far-ranging implications, actually.
Yeah.
But I mean, in the military itself, though, is this just a question not just of war expediency, but also of leadership? I mean, military people love debating leadership all the time. That's
right.
Stanley McChrystal's new career right now. It's probably going to be General Petraeus's as well.
Yeah.
So is this just like crappy leadership? Is it leaders being put in kind of an impossible situation where they need to, in a way, make their numbers and are forced to compromise as a result of it? Or do you think it's kind of a deeper endemic issue about how the military has kind of evolved in the last 12 years of constant combat? And it's just almost by design created these sorts of vulnerabilities that pragmatically don't really have a solution.
I think it's a little bit of both, right? I mean, theoretically, right, starting as a cadet and into, you know, all of your officer training, you know, going into, you know, staff colleges and the war colleges, everything's selfless service, country first, integrity, all this good stuff. But the incentives are often not that. You know, the incentives are often to sort of bend the rules, to look the other way, to make your numbers, to fudge things. And I think by and large, the integrity is quite high, and people, you know, sort of make hard choices and put themselves at risk. But if you're not making the numbers in terms of, you know, of recruitment and retention, the pressures are there, and frankly, you may just get overridden. You may, you know, the platoon leader or the instructor level may decide, hey, we're going to fail this person, and it gets countermanded up the chain. The institutional pressures are against doing the right thing sometimes. And I think, and by the way, it's not just the military. I mean, it's true in, you know, academic institutions. It's true in businesses. You know, there is you know, a bureaucracy sometimes works against doing the right thing, that's pretty clearly the right thing, you know, to people at the front line.
While agreeing with you, one of the arguments deployed, and I mean, I've made this too, is that the military can't really tolerate the kind of breaks of discipline that someone like Manning represents. That, as you said earlier, allowing a private first class to make ginormous decisions about national security and the public interest just won't fly in the military. That's just unacceptable. So, I mean, how is there a way to then square that circle between military leaders being forced to cut corners because of the exigencies of their own bureaucracy and of the war and the need to not break discipline? I mean, is this just one of those like inherent contradictions to being in a long war that we sort of have to accept and try to minimize knowing it's imperfect? Or I mean, do you see a way out of that in some way?
I don't think there is. I mean, part of it's just a, you know, it's a function of scale, right? I mean, you know, it's a big army, and you know, you've got a lot of privates first class. You've got a lot of people, you know, handling classified materials. I mean, one of the problems we've created, I mean, when this, you know, thing first broke with Manning, you know, one of my colleagues here at the Atlanta Council, who is a former ambassador to Turkey, is like, you know, why is some, you know, private first class in the army having access to diplomatic cables, to which he has no conceivable need to know. And it's because, you know, after 9/11, you know, that the clamor was for reducing stovepipes. So maybe we reduced them a little bit too much. But, you know, I mean,
and again, just to clarify, stovepipes are when agencies kind of compartmentalize information inside themselves. I'm just making sure, because like when two people who know the system start talking, there's a tendency to segue into jargon. Stovepiping is when an agency or an office essentially communicates only with itself.
Right.
And removing stovepipes is when you increase the communication between agencies. Like what you're referring to is when the 9/11 Commission report actually blamed the stovepiping of information for why the various agencies of the United States, from the State Department to the FBI to the CIA to the NSA, were unable to connect the dots that they had into a picture of the hijackers. They had all of the data on hand, but because legally they could not communicate that data with each other, they were unable to coordinate a response to prevent the attacks from happening. The response to that was agencies on their secret and top secret networks began broadcasting more and more information to each other, which created the environment where Bradley Manning, as a private first class, was able to access a lot of data he really would have no otherwise conceivable need to know, was a response to this vulnerability or the shortcoming that the 9/11 Commission identified.
No, that's right. You know, it used to be sort of one of my sort of pet peeves, you know, the movies and television portrayals of, you know, this sort of world. You know, classic is like in the movie Top Gun, right? It's like, well, you know, I've got a top secret clearance. And it's like, well, you know, big whoop, right? It's not a library card, right? Because you have a clearance doesn't mean, you know, you get to be read into anything that you happen to be curious about. Well, as it turns out, that is how it seems to be working, right? I mean, there's no reason Bradley Manning should have had access to some of this stuff, but he did because, you know, the way the system is set up. And partly it's just, you know, I think, some of the people who designed the systems don't quite understand how networking works, so we haven't figured out the rules yet for this sort of thing. You've got that many people, it's a problem. You got that many people with access to that much information, it's hard to safeguard it. And again, if Manning's, you know, current commander doesn't realize, you know, if the stuff's not being passed on to him or whatever, you know, I don't know what you do. If somebody isn't taking the initiative to pull this clearance, you sort of got to put them to work, and it's just it's an accident waiting to happen. I mean, obviously, they had no reason to understand that he had this agenda or this relationship with Assange or any of that sort of thing. But, you know, they knew he was sort of unstable and therefore untrustworthy, and that should have been enough. But
you know, the stuff that Manning leaked was classified at the secret level, and there's something like 4 million people with access to secret information in this country.
Yeah.
And frankly, I'm surprised that there's only one Manning.
Yeah,
just put it that way. And I think that actually speaks to the system working a lot better than we think it does. Just like with Edward Snowden, there are 900,000 people with clearances similar to his. There's only one Snowden.
Yeah.
And that contrast, I think, when you're dealing with almost literally one in a million or one in 4 million,
yeah.
Despite the damage that those leaks do, I think it's actually surprising that the system and the trust in that system works as well as it does.
Well, yeah, it's just, but it's got to work better, right? I mean, it's yes,
of course.
Yeah, sort of like counterterrorism, right? Is you've got to stop it every time, right? You stop stopping
exactly.
100 attacks, and one gets through, it's one too many,
And one of the consequences, I think, of what Manning did, and this is something that I'm a little surprised doesn't get more attention when people talk about it, is that he didn't just expose quote unquote war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. I call, you know, what people call war crimes there, I call combat. But he didn't just expose those things happening in Iraq and Afghanistan. He also exposed, what was it, 500,000 diplomatic cables, something like
right.
that, some obscenely high number of diplomatic cables, which unraveled statecraft. Like, he attacked the system of international statecraft by indiscriminately leaking the State Department's internal communications. He undermined diplomacy, which a lot of the people supporting him say that they support.
Right.
He undermined negotiations, which a lot of the people supporting him say they want. And he removed key diplomatic officials, specifically the ambassador to Libya right before a crisis hit Libya and we needed to have a diplomatic frontman there. We didn't have an ambassador in Tripoli during the Arab Spring because of Bradley Manning.
Yeah.
And I think that was largely responsible for why the U.S. was unable to contain it through negotiation, because they had no senior official there that could really spearhead it. So there are a lot of these consequences, these diplomatic and statecraft consequences to what Manning, this one person, was able to leak because of that system, because of that vulnerability, that also speaks to why the government, I think, pushed for such a harsh sentence on him, is they don't want someone else with no experience. When you're 24, you don't have experience.
No.
Even if you've been handling intelligence for 2 or 3 years, you don't have experience. As much as people like to think that they do, I have 2 whole years experience doing this, it doesn't compare to someone
right.
having 10, 15, or 20. Someone with the actual authority to gauge the sensitivity of information.
Yeah,
so you
that's
don't
right.
want someone with that little experience making decisions that have global consequences, global diplomatic consequences.
Yeah, and that's the problem. I mean, I've written quite a bit about this. And, you know, while I absolutely agree with Glenn Greenwald and others that we way overclassify things. We classify things for the wrong reason, et cetera.
Absolutely. There's no question about that.
And we've got to fix that. But it's a hard fix, partly because Congress won't do its job.
But also because there are no incentives, and this is something I actually faced when I worked in the intelligence community. You can almost search at random on JWIX, which is the top secret network, or on CIPR, which is the secret network. You can almost search at random and find documents that are classified at a level that, by the Director of National Intelligence's own guidelines, don't qualify.
Right.
Namely, that they're specifically in the national interest, that they involve some sort of specific vulnerability, and that were that information to be made public, specific grave harm would be done to national security.
Right.
There are lots and lots of things that are classified unnecessarily. The problem is that also within the system, and this is a leadership issue within the intelligence community, there are zero, precisely zero incentives for classifying something properly. And there are thousands, literally thousands of incentives to classify them above where they possibly
including the fact that as
an intelligence analyst, if you don't use enough highly classified details in your own reporting, your boss will ask you to use more details.
Right.
Because the assumption is that higher classification means higher relevance.
Yes.
I ran into this multiple times trying to write open source intelligence, literally pulling from news accounts, Twitter, stuff like that.
Sure.
And my bosses would say, you need higher level trafficking. Or higher level traffic, I should say, meaning messages, meaning higher classification, because they assumed, I think correctly, that their bosses, getting up to the policymaking level, wouldn't read something built out of open source. They would only read something built out of top
right.
secret stuff. Because of that, it creates a really powerful incentive for people interested in their own careers to favor, or in some cases to overly favor or overemphasize, highly classified information.
Right.
And that's an incentive structure that I don't know how you can realistically change, not only without congressional changes to how classification works, but presidential leadership, which needs to step in and actually say, this is way too far, and we need to scale this back. The other side of it, though, is that you don't change that by leaking things. The problem is that by leaking things, especially in the willy-nilly way that it's been happening recently, you actually inspire the opposite reaction. Bureaucracies tend to adopt defensive crouches instead of proactive adaptation. Yeah. And what you're seeing right now are even stronger reactions to classify things at an even higher level under the assumption that that would then increase the deterrence and the consequences of leaking, supposedly making leaks less likely. But what it means is that things also will get overclassified.
Yeah, that, and you make it harder for people to do their jobs, right? So you'll have to have three people simultaneously monitoring things, which we're going to treat like.
And that becomes moronic after a certain point. It's just if the system is that vulnerable to individual choice, then the system is fundamentally flawed. And I think there's an acknowledgement that that's the case. There has been for a long time, but no one really knows how to change it. Part of it is just the scale. I mean, if we're honest about it, the intelligence community could probably be cut in half with no discernible drop in function, basically by just eliminating duplicative functions and duplicative offices. No one wants to do that because then you're also cutting, millions of jobs in the process?
Yeah.
And that has political consequences. But acknowledging the fact that just the scale of it is itself a problem. But also, no one wants to be responsible for cutting intelligence and then getting blamed for that when another attack comes.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's the other incentive here, and that's a political incentive. This is also, I think, what's driving from the presidential perspective, from Obama's perspective. He doesn't want to be seen cutting a program that could conceivably deter or prevent the next attack. If he scales down the intelligence community – and then suddenly something slips through that maybe could have been caught otherwise. He's going to get blamed for it. His party's going to get blamed for it. The people in Congress who voted for it are going to get blamed for it.
And the intelligence committee will ensure that, right? Because they will say, well, exactly. We would have caught it. We would have done it.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And this is where I think, one of the things that both Manning and Snowden prompted, which I think will be a healthy long-term consequence of their leaks, is this discussion about what actually constitutes an appropriate intelligence community and what constitutes an inappropriate intelligence community. And it's something that people really don't grapple with to a great degree. Specifically, what it would take to change so that everyone else's preferences, the civil libertarian purists and other people who are nervous or anxious about the potential for abuse, how they would actually change functions in a way that's not only in line with their preferences, but also politically feasible. And I don't think the politics of that gets grappled with very often.
Yeah, and the problem is that, it's sort of both sides are sort of in a bond, right? The people who are on the outside talking about it don't know what they're talking about, don't understand it, and have a simplistic view of it. And frankly, the people inside the system, often have an incentive to exaggerate, the level of the threat, exaggerate the level of oversight, professionalism, dedication that's going on, and exaggerate the need for, all this secrecy. And of course, sort of going, touching back on something you talked about earlier, which is, the fact that something is highly classified and you don't have access to it makes you smart, right? Because the officials can basically say, well, if you knew what I know, you would agree with me. But I can't tell you what
Which
I know
is
because
the
it's fine.
Most obnoxious response anyone can adopt to a question.
Right.
I mean, but it just is. It's childish.
Yeah.
But that's bringing up something interesting that the White House's response to all of this has been extraordinarily counterproductive in a lot of ways because they haven't. I mean, Obama has never mentioned that issue as something that is in a way tying his hands. Or if not, at least greatly complicating any kind of irrational response. Just like how with a lot of the NSA stuff, he's never actually explained why these programs exist or what they do. It's just, well, trust us, we tell Congress.
Yeah.
That's clearly not good enough anymore.
He's been sort of shockingly absent on so many of these issues. So he just takes care of his leadership style, and it's, I hate to sort of go into the community organizer trope, but I think it is that methodology, which is you sort of let everybody sort of exhaust themselves, have their discussion, and then you sort of step in at the last minute and save the day by showing a middle ground. He has a tendency to do that in a lot of issues. He weighs in far later than anybody else would have. George W. Bush would have been on this, in a couple of days. He'd been out there defending the NSA, defending the program.
The consequence of that is that he loses control of the conversation. And I think at this point, the White House has decidedly lost control of the public debate over this.
That's a weird thing, because Dianne Feinstein's been more out there than the president on this.
Which is crazy, because she's normally not.
Well, somebody's got to, so right?
I don't understand the decision-making that's been going into this. I don't understand the fecklessness of the administration in the wake of really, really strong attacks on their legitimacy. I don't get it. Like, I wouldn't be making those choices if I was in their position. I can't internalize their decision making. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, although I will say that, while they've done a really lousy job of courting public opinion, I think they do have on their side the fact that nothing's going to change, right? There's zero impetus in Congress to change anything. Ron Wyden and, Rand Paul aside, nothing's going to change.
Right.
The impetus is for more classification, more money for intelligence, and that sort of thing. So, everybody in Congress is rallying. Even they say, well, okay, they lied to us about it, but they've saved lives, so good.
At the end of the day, though, what that ends up accomplishing is just getting everyone mad for nothing.
Yeah. No.
So, I don't understand why they think they're going to be better off through this.
I don't understand.
Looking ahead, there are going to be, I think, some really interesting things to watch out for. One is actually what you were talking about in Congress, how like this is kind of a side note, but in this whole discussion about whether things are like legitimate whistleblowing or just crass leaking, I'm of the opinion that I think Edward Snowden, even though I still think his leaks are damaging and I would have preferred had he not done them, he has a much more legitimate claim to whistleblowing.
Sure.
Than Manning does, because he has exposed things that are worrying to enough people that it's actually prompting, first of all, a debate in Congress and more importantly, a debate in the public. In a way that the stuff Manning exposed, a lot of it is terrible, but it didn't have any effect. It didn't seem to really change anyone's opinions or add to anyone's knowledge of these conflicts. So the reaction to that is going to be really interesting to see going forward, is kind of in light of these two enormous leaks – what Congress is actually going to be able to do, in a way. I don't have an answer for that. I was kind of leaving it open to you to see if you did.
No, Congress has shown no interest. I wrote a piece for the Atlantic.
I don't think they've shown no interest. I mean, the Amash Amendment came pretty close to getting out of the House.
Yeah, but I mean the problem
is it
wouldn't
have gone anywhere in the Senate, but it came close.
But the problem is that with the war on terror generally, right? There's almost no consequence to more, because even if people disagree with you, you sort of get but they're doing it in the interest of national security, and they're just sort of going overboard, and we shouldn't spend as much money, we shouldn't do these things, but I understand why they're doing it. And going the other direction, you sort of be called weak and weak on terror and soft on crime or whatever. So I think that the incentives are so much in the other direction that nothing's going to happen.
And I would kind of leave it as a suggestion to the activists that do want to really meaningfully change it. Looking at how those incentives can be altered, not just expressing moral outrage in public, which is an important first step, but not just expressing moral outrage, actually looking at how you can change the political incentives that created this institution and these structures to begin with.
Right.
I think I even made this case when Manning got convicted, is it's really hard to change a huge bureaucracy like that. It's easy to just steal a bunch of stuff and throw it on the internet.
Right.
In a way, it's lazy to just do that. I actually called Manning lazy.
Right.
But it's really hard to change something, to permanently change it in a legal way. And I, you know, that just reminded me of something. I've been several times in this conversation referring to Manning as he.
Yeah.
And as of this morning, that's no longer appropriate because he's now officially identifying himself as female.
Right.
And is going to be undergoing both counseling and probably hormone replacement therapy in some way.
Yeah.
To transition to being a woman. So that's also going to be, I think, an interesting kind of last wrinkle to this whole thing. Is Manning starting prison at the same time that he is becoming she?
Yeah, and I don't know, you know, that we're equipped to handle it, both as a society in terms of just grappling with the issue intellectually, let alone sort of emotionally, and let alone institutionally, procedurally. Certainly, I mean, you know, the military has gone within the space of a few months now from it, you know, not being allowed to be in the service, as an open homosexual, to being allowed to marry and get benefits. In fact, get free vacation time if you're homosexual and want to get married and you happen to be stationed somewhere where you can't do that. You know, we'll give you some, we won't charge you leave for it. So we've made that radical a transformation in just a matter of months. But we've got no clue.
And it's interesting to see an institution. Yeah, and actually, I mean, it's been really interesting to see an institution that is traditionally considered kind of this conservative bulwark in American society to be one of the most socially progressive institutions of the federal government.
Yeah, it's
I agree with you. That transition, that transformation has been really, really fascinating. Although this morning the Army did say that they are not going to provide counseling or physical medical assistance to that transition.
They don't
there's
no policy on this yet, and I don't know how how the Army is going to deal with it, but they will, and they'll be forced to, I think, pretty quickly. If not by the President and the Secretary of Defense, they'll be forced by the courts. I think there's already some precedents on even with regard to prisoners that they have a right to this sort of thing, and including. Yeah, a right to it being covered under their medical benefits, basically, so the taxpayer has to pay for it, which is an odd thing because in most states medical insurance doesn't cover sexual reassignment surgery or even counseling and hormone replacement therapy. It's still sort of at the cutting edge of our public policy,
it is.
So maybe this will launch a discussion. I mean, the initial discussion of this sort of thing is immature, and we're gonna make a lot of jokes about it. But I think pretty quickly we're gonna have a conversation.
I mean, it's outright transphobic, is what it is. I mean, I've seen on Twitter and elsewhere some really really hateful things being said. Whatever Manning's crimes are and whatever one feels about his crimes, I don't think that justifies saying, I have known in the past, I don't currently anymore, we lost track, but I have known in the past, trans people that initial phase of trying to come to grips with it and then deciding to seek to change is incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
And, if nothing else, here's where I break people's caricature of myself. If nothing else, I do hope that this prompts some humane discussion of what trans people really face.
Yeah.
In terms of just trying to first identify themselves and then afterwards seek to transition, because it's an incredibly difficult thing to go through.
And, oh, it is, no question.
I mean, despite my feelings of Manning's crimes and my belief in the justness of his prison sentence, I feel genuine empathy for what he's going through because it's going to be really, really difficult.
Absolutely.
I'm sure being in prison is going to make it incredibly difficult on top of just the normal difficulty of it.
Yeah, and part of, we're a society that tolerates and and makes sport of and everything else, the epidemic of rape in our prisons. I think we think that people that go to prison are sort of what they deserve, whatever's coming to them. I think our sympathy for Manning and his desire to present in a different gender, it will be pretty low, at least in the beginning, but it's a conversation we've got to have.
Well, and I mean, And, you know, prison is one of those cases where it shows that it's okay to joke about rape if it's a man getting raped.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, yeah, that's a whole separate topic that's, like, way, way away from what we're talking about today.
Oh, no, absolutely.
I just think Manning's decision to officially begin transition right when the prison is starting, and I'm going out of my way right now to use gender pronouns because it's awkward and I'm going to trip myself up.
Oh yeah.
I don't know any word for it other than fascinating. It's a really fascinating and almost anxiety producing wrinkle at the end of this whole story.
Yeah, and you know, I think one temptation is to see it as sort of a, you know, as a ploy, but the fact is that we've learned fairly recently, he, you know, sort of made these issues known to, you know, mm-hmm. to the Army before his crimes. You know, yeah. So this is not a new thing. It's just, a pretty natural progression of a thing that's been going on for a while.
Yeah. So I think this is a fairly organic place to end this. So, Jim, yeah. Thanks for talking. It's been a very wide-ranging discussion, actually.
Yes.
Yeah. So with that, I bid you adieu.
Take care.